Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do different kinds of schools tailor their environments to the resources, goals, and challenges of their students and teachers? And what sorts of adaptations have the greatest impact on achievement? For today's discussion, we've invited administrators from three very different Dallas campuses to talk about the ways they approach their shared mission of helping all their students learn what they need to succeed. April Allen is executive director of the Kip Truth Academy in Dallas. That's a charter school. Leslie Sharp is principal of Fraser Elementary School in DISD, which is a public school. And Michael Simpson is head of the lower school at Greenhill School, which is private. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
So you come to us from three very different places. Given that you're all committed to providing your students with the best possible experience, I want to briefly ask each of you what you think of as the differences between you. And we'll start with you, April, from Kip Truth Academy.
Thanks, Chris. Well, I think what is the most obvious difference between KIPP schools and traditional schools is the extended day. We spend more time each day, each week, and really the school year with our students. So our students are in class from 7:30 to 5, Monday through Friday, two half-day Saturday schools a month, and then an extra 3 weeks in the summertime. I think that would be the most obvious difference. Mm-hmm. The other things that make us different, though, I think at KIPP are really our focus on results. Nationally, 85% of students who complete eighth grade at a KIPP school will go on to college. And we're really proud of that statistic because we know that's not always the case in the neighborhoods where our kids come from. Locally, our kids come to us typically reading and doing math at the third grade level in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. And by the time they leave us, they are typically on grade and surpassing their peers in district schools on state tests like the tax test in math and reading. So we're really excited about that. And then finally, I think the big difference would be just the autonomy and flexibility that our leaders have. Our school leaders are provided flexibility around how they administer the curriculum. So we do still teach the same core standards that are required by the state, because we are a public school as a charter school, but our teachers and principal have the flexibility around how they deliver that curriculum and core instruction.
And Leslie Sharp from Fraser Elementary in DISD.
Yes, ma'am. I agree with a lot of what April said, and I think one of the main differences of public school versus the private and the charter school are the various type of students that we have. We have them from all over. We don't have a choice of what students come to us. And another thing, we have a managed curriculum within our school district that we do follow. Also, in a public school setting, we have to provide many interventions for students to help get them on grade level. So our goal is to have every student college ready and produce productive citizens, but there are many different things we have to do to make sure they get on grade level, stay on grade level, and move above grade level.
And Michael Simpson of the Greenhill School?
I think for us it's that independence. You know, we're independently governed and we're independently managed and we're independently financed. So what that means for us is that we are free to teach what we want to teach, develop our own standards, teach them how we want to teach them. We're also have that independence in terms of our enrollment. So we admit children we think will thrive in our environment and make those decisions from there.
And talk, any and all of you, about the balance between autonomy for teachers and also guidance and best practices for teachers.
Well, one question we often ask is that should teachers have autonomy? And the answer is yes, but not autonomy to do whatever you want to do. The autonomy comes as long as those best practices that we have developed are aligned with the curriculum and the goals of the school, of the learning community, and of the district. And what we find is that when the teachers do have autonomy, you see students achieving higher. But that autonomy is, again, that which we have trained. There are many things we talk about when we talk about best practices, from strategies that we use in the classroom, from resources that we use in the classroom. So with autonomy, there is a certain amount of autonomy, but that autonomy, it comes from the professional development that we have given our teachers.
So the destination is fixed, but the route can vary.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I think for us, there's a definite consistency that you'll see from one classroom to the next. So, you know, we want to ensure that our kids are focused on learning. So we provide a structure and discipline in each classroom that allows us to focus on that. That means that I think in a typical school, a child might know that Mrs. Smith is the one that's really going to, you know, come down on me hard, whereas Miss Jones might be a little more flexible. And in our school, every teacher has the same expectation for how that child will behave in the classroom. So that's where the consistency comes in for us, and that allows us to focus on learning. But I think the flexibility comes around how they can deliver and teach that curriculum. And so they make it fun. You know, in math class, they're learning their math times tables to chants and to rhymes and to rap. And you know, just making sure that that learning is being done, but being done in a fun way.
Do your teachers tend to be on the tough side? Is that how you'd characterize them?
I would say that we definitely say discipline comes before learning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our environment is very structured and our students are very clear about the expectations around how they behave in the classroom, how they treat their peers, how they respond to and listen to teachers, adults. But again, we're ensuring that we have that discipline and structure so that the teacher's not focused on the extraneous things that happen in the classroom, but really allowed to focus the kids on learning because we want to make sure that they are continuing on that path to college and through college.
How does it work at Green Hill?
You know, I think for us, autonomy is crucial to good learning in the classroom. And the challenge is balancing that autonomy with the organizational goals, with grade, you know, starting grade level. What are the goals across the grade level? We're a medium-sized school. We've got five classrooms to coordinate at each grade level in my division. And so if you had five different things going on in every classroom, you'd be a little scattered. You know, I think historically in private schools, the approach was hire great people and let them do their thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in the past 20 years, we've moved away from that and tried to do quite a bit of curriculum mapping, organize, develop around standards and goals for the whole journey and then breaking it down through that vertical ladder and making sure that we're moving forward together. What Leslie said about professional mm-hmm. development is a big part of it for us, too.
Well, it's an interesting evolution because great people are not necessarily great teachers. It's a totally different skill set on top of knowing what you need to know.
I would agree with that. And what I have found is that there's no teacher that comes to work every day saying, I want to fail mm-hmm. and I don't want kids to learn. And those people who have that will, even though they may not be a great teacher, but they have that will and desire to be developed, end up going from good to being great.
You know, and I think for us, what we recognize is that, especially for the population we serve, KIPP schools are focused on getting kids from underserved neighborhoods. Our population is, you know, the South Central, Oak Cliff. We've got almost 90% free and reduced lunch, 55% African American, 45% Hispanic. So this is a population that's typically been underserved. Mm-hmm. And we need teachers who really believe that those kids have the potential to be the greatest, do the greatest, and achieve. You know, we abide by the saying that all kids not just can learn, but will learn. And so it's important for us to have teachers who really intrinsically believe that regardless of what that kid's situation is, what their demographic is, what might be going on at home, you know, what zip code they come from, that they have the potential to succeed and that that teacher can help them do that.
You know, another piece for us is that concept of team synergy. I mean, I think as we've moved away from teachers working autonomously in their classrooms, closed doors, and who knows what's going on in there. We've moved to working in teams. So the teachers are working to develop their standards and their approach and their activities and their lessons as part of a group. And that's, you know, what we think our kids are moving toward as they leave our school, a world that looks more like that. And so I think that's also reflected in what we're doing.
How satisfied are your teachers with the professional development opportunities that exist, not on your campuses, but, you know, when they go and take a seminar somewhere? Are those pretty helpful?
I think they vary. I mean, I think we'll hear sometimes that was a great workshop. The teachers want things they can walk out of and walk out of the workshop and apply it immediately in their mm-hmm. classroom. They're not so interested in theory in workshops. They're interested in actual things they can put in place.
And I agree with that. And what I'm starting to see with teachers and professional development is that they want more professional development that's tailored to what they do. So I am finding that we're able to do more professional development on campus with teacher experts or people coming in the classroom and doing those types of activities with their students versus, you know, going out to many places, bringing things back and putting them on the shelves. I'm starting to see teachers, like April brought up a good point, that they have to believe that the kids can do. And so they're interested in what else can I do? And just like earlier mentioned that collaboration with other teachers, they're finding, hey, we do have some experts on campus and we don't always have to leave to get mm-hmm. professional development.
And for us, what's exciting is that we are a part of the national network of KIPP schools. So across the country, there are 99 KIPP schools in 20 states and the District of Columbia. So we benefit from sharing across our network. I mean, we certainly have local professional development opportunities and our teachers can go outside locally. But they can also learn from teachers in L.A. or D.C. who are teaching fifth grade math and think about, you know, how are they making that lesson interesting, exciting, and, you know, continuing to help our kids achieve the results that we know they can achieve.
If you have two different teachers come in with the exact same credentials, how do you choose which one to hire?
Well, we want to see some energy in the classroom. And so for us, when we hire, teaching is a part of that day, mm-hmm. Without a doubt, without question. And the problem there is limiting the number of adults that come into the room to observe them.
Closed-circuit cameras at some point.
Right. So, you know, you look at the credentials, but you want to see how they interact with the kids. Mm-hmm. And to us, that is top of the list. Can they interact warmly? Is it a good experience for the kids? Does it look like it's a good experience for the adult? And then back to that team idea, you know, throughout the day, do they appear to us to be a team player? Mm-hmm.
Well, for us, you know, again, I think it goes back to that belief in what's possible in our population and in the kids that we serve. You know, we're asking of our teachers a lot more than they would typically be required to do in I think, a traditional public school in that, you know, we have longer school days. We expect them to be available by cell phone to answer questions for the kids up till 9 p.m. every night. So we need people who are truly committed to our mission, which is to get these kids who we know don't have the same options that their counterparts do in other parts of the city, get them to and through college. And we need to sort of see that fire in their eyes and the belief in what's possible for our kids.
And to add what both of you all said, including the interaction with the kids and that belief, we also ask many questions and let them interview with several people on our campus so we all can see what strengths they might bring to our campus that we don't already have. What can they do to enhance our campus? And it's not just a matter of what they say, but there may be different activities that we do with that candidate just to see if they're really sincere about what they say.
What criteria go into the idea of diversity on your campuses? Because you can look at age diversity, you can look at ethnic and racial diversity, you can look at background and geographic location. What do you all use in that formula?
Do you mean from a staffing perspective?
Yeah, Or is it something that you think about, provided they're good teachers, can they all be exactly the same?
You know, I don't think that we explicitly think about how our staff needs to sort of what the makeup of the staff mm-hmm. needs to be. But I do think that there's a benefit to having teachers who respect the cultures that our children come from and yeah. can in some way appreciate and share, have a shared experience with them. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, we don't specifically think about makeup from a diversity perspective.
I don't think we really don't either. I think it just naturally seems to happen mm-hmm. that we just have diversity on campus mm-hmm. because that's just what's best for kids.
Right.
And we just hire the best candidates.
I guess this is one area where we're a little bit different. We very consciously think about diversity, and I guess maybe that some of that is because of the history of private schooling and what it's looked like.
It used to be overwhelmingly wealthy and white.
Right,
is that what
exactly.
Mean?
Uh-huh. And so, you know, our mission of our school, diversity is a centerpiece of that. From our curriculum, from our design, from our admissions standpoint, we want a diverse environment because it's right, and we also think that's where our kids are moving toward. The demographics of this country are changing, and we want them to experience that in school as much as they can, as they will in life. So we very consciously look at that in our staff and do the best we can in that area.
Michael Simpson is head of the lower school at Green Hill. Leslie Sharp is principal of Fraser Elementary in DISD. That's a public school. And April Allen is executive director of the charter school KIPP Truth Academy in Dallas. We'll resume our conversation about education in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about differences in education and approaches to education with April Allen, who is Executive Director of the Kip Truth Academy in Dallas. That's a charter school. Michael Simpson, head of the lower school at the private school Green Hill. And Leslie Sharp, who is principal of Fraser Elementary in DISD. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One of the ways I know that your jobs differ is in your ability to, if it's not working out with a particular teacher, to let that teacher go. And maybe we'll start this time with you, Michael, and talk about what happens if a teacher somehow, for whatever reason, is just not a good fit.
Well, we have an evaluation process, and we use that for all our teachers. And so we apply that evaluation process to that particular teacher. I think in the case of a teacher that we're concerned about, it shifts a little bit from the professional development realm to the we need to see some immediate improvement in your performance realm. So we'll work with that teacher through that process, set goals, provide resources, provide some benchmarks to see where we're going to see improvement. And if it doesn't work out and they haven't reached the goals, then we can just sever the relationship.
So it's not a complicated process for you?
Not technically. Emotionally it can because these people you work very closely with. Mm-hmm. But not really. I mean, our teachers have a one-year letter of appointment, mm-hmm. and they're renewed every year. And if we choose not to renew one, then we look for somebody else.
How does it work for you, Leslie?
Well, our system is a little bit different. We also have an evaluation process, and I'm sure it's the same. This part is the same with all of us. We go through the professional development piece, but if for some reason that person is not working out, then there comes a next step where we begin a documentation process of either, you want to be here or you don't, and this is what you need to do. But it most teachers who have been in the district and are experienced have a 2-year contract. So in order to non-renew, you have to continue the process. You have to provide interventions for that teacher. And you have to be able to prove that they did not show growth or meet those goals. And so that process could take 2 years, up to 2 years.
I've heard you say in the past that when a teacher isn't succeeding, you feel like in some ways it's your responsibility to make that happen.
Absolutely, because what I'm finding and throughout the years that there are more teachers who are willing and just unable. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, no teacher just gets up and says, today I just want to be unsuccessful. I don't want any kid to learn. And so when you start, just like you do the kids, you try to meet the needs of the teachers and figure out what's going on. Those usually come through private conversations with the teachers. Just those one-on-one, heart-to-heart talks. Not evaluation, but let's talk. Mm-hmm. And you find that there are just gaps in their learning and their understanding to which you can kind of help feel and watch them grow. That is not an easy process, and it's not quick, and sometimes it takes a couple of years to develop that teacher.
How do you handle it, April?
Our process is actually quite similar to what Michael described. I mean, the same evaluation process. We will certainly try to work from a professional development standpoint, setting goals and milestones, etc. But at the end of the day, if we see that it's not working out, we do have that flexibility to move in a new direction.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's take a call from Sarah in North Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Yes, hi. I just feel compelled to call because someone there mentioned a key component to this whole thing about education. And that is that they said that it's what the optimism or the
belief that it's possible.
What the belief mm-hmm. of the teacher has about that student, the expectations. If a teacher believes a student is bright, intelligent, can learn, that student will live up to her expectations. If the teacher believes that child is just not very bright, can't learn, then they will not learn. Mm-hmm. So it really the key, I think, is with the teachers, how good of motivators they are. How good of a coach. They're just like coaches. And I myself experienced that coming from a minority standpoint at the time when I was growing up in a suburb, which there weren't very many Hispanics at all. And I was treated that way, treated like most of my teachers that they didn't think that I was very smart just because of that perception of being Hispanic. And did you know I did not go to college until I'd been working for a few years, I realized I was a smart person and that I could get a college education. I went back to school, and I wanted to prove to those teachers that I was a bright, I was intelligent young woman, and I did. I got my teaching certification, my degree in education, and went on to get a master's, and that is my whole point. Now I just felt, because I'm getting older, I only saw, but I do a lot of mentoring as well. I think part of the job
Yeah, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And that's such a great point, that mentoring is important, and that I guess it can be really very discouraging if a child doesn't feel like anybody believes in him or her.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to have people in the building who don't have that preconceived notion about what is possible for a child and really truly believe that anything's possible. And that's, you know, at KIPP what we certainly believe. And I'm sure that that belief is shared with my colleagues as well.
I want to talk a little bit about technology. I have four kids in school, and they immediately knew what a smart board was, and I had to go look this thing up, and then it sounds remarkable, and I wanted to play with one myself. They're in all three of your schools?
Yes.
Yes.
What do they do, and what have they changed?
Well, we went from blackboards to whiteboards, marker boards, and now we're at smart boards, which look like whiteboards, but you can touch them and write on them and then print it out. You can have animation. You can prepare your lessons ahead of time and throw it up almost like an overhead projector on the screen, and then interact with it in a way that's much more visible and easier to manage. So it's a wonderful tool for teachers to have for a variety of reasons. It just makes the classroom more efficient. I think what people need to be careful about is that a smart board or any other form of technology, in my opinion, is not the be-all, end-all. Mm-hmm. It's really still what happens in the classroom and how that teacher uses that tool. So a smart board for us is a new tool. It's a wonderful tool, but you need to learn to use it appropriately. And all the other things that happen in the classroom have to be wonderful too.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the number one resource is the teacher. So yeah. The technology is only as good as the teacher is. And I agree, what happens with the smart board and different types of technology, it just makes it more interesting to the kids. It holds their interest a little longer. So what they're able to make connections to their learning based on what they've done with the smart board, because they're actually interacting. They're actually touching the board. They're involved with the instruction. They're engaged.
The three of you are all young, but I know you've been educators for some time. Have you noticed a change in... Everyone's laughing at me. You all look young. My 40-year-old eyes, but...
Working with kids.
I wonder if you've noticed a change in attention spans. The years gone by, and is it harder for kids to focus on things for an extended amount of time than it used to be?
Absolutely. I would say yes, especially with the gaming age and all the technology the students are that's available to them. I watched a young man at a basketball game last night who was just engaged with an iPhone, and he was going 90 to nothing with the iPhone. But kids' attention spans are different. It's almost, we joke about this, but we say the teacher almost has to become a video game to keep connecting with those students.
I would definitely agree. And I think what's so amazing is that when you sit in a classroom with a teacher and see how they manage a lesson plan, you know, I think back to when I was in school and it felt like we spent most of the period kind of talking through some content, whereas now they're sort of pivoting from one thing to the next and transitioning from, you know, maybe it's a lesson to group work to individual work. And so I think that, you know, it's very important to kind of maintain that attention, keep them interested, and do things that make lessons fun, like the chance, like learning math, you know, to rap songs and
I hesitantly agree. You know, to me, this is a really interesting thing that I've been watching for the last 20 years, an attention span. And I think, yes, the electronic media has influenced our kids, and I think Baby Beethoven and all that stuff. You know, but I think what I work with our teachers is our expectation of kids and just not needing them to sit still for 25 to 30 minutes at a time silently. I mean, I think that's an unreasonable expectation in any age for children. And I'm happy to see, I think, our culture returning to a sense of early childhood, where the things that we're asking younger children to do especially are better for those kids. You know, asking kindergartners to sit, in my opinion, for a long time without moving is just ridiculous. And so if that's what you're asking kids to do, and then you're saying, but their attention span is not the same as it used to be, then I think there's a disconnect there. And mm-hmm. I think that that's something as educators we need to be continuing to look at. Are our expectations of kids where they need to be before you start talking about their attention?
And see, I think I was relating to, I remember when we were in school and we had to sit.
Right.
And we sit.
Straight line.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
it. And that was the expectation. You sit and look. The teacher did. You did. Now you do on your own. You know, we just back to the kind of like a lesson cycle. And that was the expectation where we had to do it. So are kids doing that now? Are they easily able to do it because we said do it? And I was thinking, no. This day and time. Mm-hmm. But we do practice building stamina because you have to. You have assessments that they take and they have to learn to be still. But I think I was looking from that perspective as we did it because we were told to and we knew we had to.
And ironically, most of us aren't that way today. I was just thinking the longest sustained time that I spend doing anything is when I am on the air doing the show for 2 hours and the rest of the time I'm flitting about
right.
to different things.
Right. Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Irving and speak with Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
I'm a developer of a video game, and we're aiming towards the education market. The system basically works with letting people develop lesson plans or sort of like reports that a child might develop on a subject and let them share it across campuses. I'm curious about the educators' opportunities whenever they do develop a lesson plan to be able to share that across campuses, both, you know, equal level schools and maybe the college level back and forth. And well, another smaller question about how often are they given the opportunity to teach discernment, seeing that that's become so important?
Discernment, did you say?
Discernment.
Discernment. Well, let's get some answers for you. Thanks for your call. Is there a lot of sharing across different campuses? Maybe for you, April?
So currently we have one charter school here locally in Dallas, but like I mentioned, there are 99 schools across the country. So we certainly share from that perspective. KIPP as a community has sort of we actually call it KIPP Share, where we're able to use technology to share things like lessons plans, et cetera. So.
And Dallas ISD is large, and surprisingly, we're able to share with each other. They're actually professional developments that are set up. So as a learning community or as a district-wide campus leadership team, you're able to meet and share ideas. And even at our principal's meeting, we're even able to bring work samples of students and lessons to share.
I think we do quite a bit of sharing. We're part of a national organization called the National Association of Independent Schools, which has national conferences throughout the year. And I just returned from one in San Diego where there was just great sharing from schools like us from around the country about a variety of things. And there are there are regional versions of that. There's sort of a local version of that. We last year organized sort of a local independent school Saturday day where the teachers presented. The teachers all shared with each other things that they wanted to share. And so there's quite a bit of opportunity for that. I think from a technological standpoint, you know, we have an electronic curriculum mapping, a software program that we plug into through the internet that allows us to highlight what we think are premium lessons and then submit those for sharing for anyone who's signed on with this software company. Mm-hmm. And then we receive theirs as well. And so we're allowed to pick and choose from other premium lessons. So that's a good network, too.
And Stephen, the second part of his question was about discernment. And I'm not familiar with how that would be specifically applied to education. Maybe it makes sense to one of you.
If he's talking from the perspective of character education.
He's still on the line. Can you explain, Stephen, what you meant about discernment?
Thank you. Basically what I'm coming to with that is a lot of times we have so much information flowing at us about different subjects. You know, in the upper grades, whenever children are having to create reports, collect a lot of information, you know, their bibliographies they fill out are going to be filled with so many different sources of information, and it's become very difficult sometimes to differentiate the good information from the bad information.
Okay, thank you very
and
much.
I'm wondering how much time schools are spending to help children to understand how to discern, you know, a reliable source from something that's going to be a little bit more questionable.
Yeah, absolutely, especially I would imagine using the internet, this is more important than ever.
I think that has long been a part of research projects, whether it was discerning primary from secondary sources or other types. But definitely the internet adds a layer to this. And I feel like I've watched this over the last 20 years become more and more important for our kids. You know, at our school, we've developed a curriculum for that that begins in first grade talking about what is the source and what tells you that's a good source and what tells you that might not be a good source. And it's integrated and embedded in various aspects of our curriculum, but it's begins in first grade and continues through 12th.
It's challenging, too, because it's all – the environment is changing so fast. My children have been told never to use Wikipedia as an information source, but honestly, it's pretty good, and I use it every day. You have to sort of know how to use it, and that's it's hard when the rules from 5 years ago are not the same rules that you have today.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Jonathan in Carrollton. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I'm a student of education, and I'm planning to be a middle school gifted and talented teacher, specifically for mathematics, because I grew up in the gifted and talented program, and I saw that in my program, at least, we never really had a mathematics gifted and talented course, and I really think there's a lot of potential there to boost gifted and talented students beyond what they could exceed. So I was wanting to ask your three people what programs that they have, and do they have a mathematics gifted and talented course?
That's an interesting question, because Dallas has moved towards looking at more of effort-based learning. And with effort-based learning, what we're finding is that not just those students who have been identified gifted and talented, but other students who people believe that they can do have been moved and have been performing like gifted and talented students. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily a program that we have set aside. It's a different way of looking at how students learn and assessing what they've learned that has created that boost for the students in mathematics. So not necessarily a gifted and talented program for mathematics. It's just a gift and talent program that covers all content areas.
We will take a quick break now, and then we'll get an answer from our other teachers. My guests this hour are Leslie Sharp, who is principal of Fraser Elementary in DISD, April Allen, executive director of the Kip Truth Academy in Dallas, and Michael Simpson, head of the lower school at Green Hill School. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you want to be part of it, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about different approaches to education with April Allen, executive director of Kip Truth Academy, Leslie Sharp, principal of DISD's Fraser Elementary, and Michael Simpson, head of the lower school at Green Hill School. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And Michael, just to follow up, did you have a different answer to Jonathan about dealing with kids who have been identified? And I know there's lots of controversy about how kids get identified, but as talented and gifted.
Well, in our school, we don't identify kids as talented and gifted. I know that happens in some places. We don't feel the need to do that because of the independence that we have over our curriculum and also in our student body. I have some private concerns about identifying kids as talented and gifted at such an early age. You know, to me, from the readings I've seen about brain development and childhood development, you need to wait a lot longer before you determine someone is intellectually, in a traditional way, intellectually gifted.
Does the label hurt the kids who aren't identified as such because they're suddenly not talented and gifted?
To me, yeah, because mm-hmm. I personally believe that every child is talented and gifted in some way. Yeah. It's a matter of unlocking that. And I think in programs where you're labeling kids, you're also locking kids out from the benefits of good teaching and good program.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Shannon in Arlington. Hey, Shannon.
Hi, good afternoon. Interesting subject. I'm an educator myself. I've been teaching ESL for 9 years. The problem that I personally did not encounter that problem, but I observed that problem. You enter this school, elementary school, and the principal is of certain ethnicity, And all the qualification that she's looking for in the teachers she's hiring is where they came from. And where they came from is where she is from. Okay, and then at the cost of, let's say, 500, 600 students, and some of these teachers actually themselves, they have to start sitting at the ESL class before they are able to teach any students. And some of them, they're offered the job while going to some of the alternative schools. My question is, doesn't ISD look in the pattern that is repeated every year that barely that specific school is passing it? That means when it is announced by ISD that this school is passed, they actually celebrate. Don't they look into the situation like this and asking principals, why is it that you're barely passing that, and look in the problems or factors that contribute to the same problem?
Well, there's a lot sort of in that question. Maybe we can go to the question of evaluating standards and sort of minimum standards as opposed to really ensuring that students excel. Maybe we can take it from that angle. Testing is something that people get very spun up about, and everybody worries about teaching to the test. Is it necessary to teach to the test if students are learning most of the curriculum that they're assigned to learn?
You know, for us, as a charter school, we have to administer the same test that every public school does. So we administer the tax test, but, you know, we are not focused on making sure kids pass the tax test. That is a nice byproduct of the fact that we're giving our kids a fantastic education that's getting them college ready. And frankly, by the time they leave us in eighth grade, they are outperforming their peers at the district on the tax test. But like I said, it's not sort of something that we focus on in terms of our teaching and our curriculum. We want it to be a byproduct of passing and excelling on the tax test is something we want to be a byproduct of just a great education.
First, let me define my definition of teaching to the test is that the teacher is running off copies of release tests and exact questions, and you're constantly using that for your curriculum. You're constantly teaching the kids how to answer the questions, all the strategies to eliminate and pick an answer, versus that in Texas, our curriculum, the test is aligned to our curriculum. So some of the information on the test is in the curriculum. So is it necessary to teach the test? No, but it is necessary to, at some point in time, as you're teaching the student expectations that they're exposed to the type of questions they're going to be asked. So if I have the information, but I don't know how it's going to be asked of me, then it's going to be very difficult to be successful in a test. So we don't teach the test, but eventually some point in time, our questioning has to match that of the test to get the information that they're going to ask on the test.
Is it possible for a competent student who is performing adequately at grade level to fail tests like the tax?
It's possible. And some things that make that possible. Some kids aren't good test takers. Mm-hmm. It could be anything that happened previously before they began taking the test.
Like the night before. Right?
Exactly. School, home, or whatever. And it could also be that the student has the information, they understand the concept and content, but they don't fully understand how to answer it in the way it's being asked on the test.
Mm-hmm. Now, you at Greenhill, your students do not take tax or any of the state administered tests.
No, we don't. We do the independence and the freedom to do our own testing. So we use a national independent school test, and we use it how we want to use it. We start it in third grade, and we get the results and look at them and evaluate them and look at them over time. And, you know, we use it as a tool to evaluate ourselves.
Are you comparing class to class or this student in fourth grade and this student in sixth grade, the same individual? How does that work?
As a school tool, we do it by class. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for patterns year to year. Once we create some aggregate data, try and monitor where we're performing well, where we're not performing well. We also generate individual data that helps inform us about the progress of individual kids, and we share that data with families. Kids can do poorly on a standardized test and thrive in the classroom. And all that you can do when you see that is just start asking questions. Why is this child not performing well on the test, or what's happening? What's the disconnect?
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will go to we'll go to Grand Prairie and speak with Nathan. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. My comment's actually back on the smart board thing. Recently, I've been around on the internet looking at the stuff because I recently bought a Wii. But Johnny Lee has a Wiimote project, And he basically, with a Wiimote, mimics the entire smart board system. And he uses an infrared LED as a marker. So basically, with the infrared LED, a Wiimote, and a small projector, you can mimic the smart board thing for about a fraction of the cost. And I know most schools don't have enough in their budget to support the whole smart board system. But I was wondering if you'd ever heard about that. And I'll take my question off the air. It is quite a price decrease from the smart board system.
Well, that's a hopeful thing to know, I guess.
I mean, I've certainly never heard of it. I do appreciate hearing about cost-effective alternatives because as a charter school, we certainly have limited funds. We do get less funds from the state than your typical district school does and have to fundraise to meet our needs. So I appreciate the suggestion.
Thank you.
I've never heard of it, but if it's brought to me, we'll pilot it and try it out.
Does the presence of technology in the classroom push out traditional things like, you know, art projects and cutting and pasting, and which sometimes it looks like busy work, but in fact there's coordination that's involved and a lot of different sort of skills built into things that look like recreation?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Those are still very important because you're looking at the creativity of the students. The technology doesn't always allow you to see exactly what that student is thinking or learning. But if there are products that they are producing, you're able to have conversations about them, about their learning, their understanding, and you can help motivate them, or we call it assess or promote them to the next level of thinking.
Yeah, and those are key pieces of physical and brain development. Is, you know, cutting and picking up small things and doing all those little activities are key, and I think every good educator knows that.
So the macaroni stuff is not going away anytime soon.
No.
Oh, no.
Oh,
good.
No. And it's cheap.
I was at my daughter's school yesterday, and they had made the cutest little menorahs with little macaronis for each candle, and I had just never seen anything so adorable.
Oh, yes.
It's amazing how resourceful teachers can be given limited resources. So.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll go to Paul in Farmers Branch. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Great show. I had a question on, does your panel think that there's a different way to teach boys and girls? I got two boys in middle school, and they're making A's and B's, but they're constantly getting referrals for misdemeanors, talking, cutting up in class. I'm just wondering if there's a different way to teach the boys and the girls, or if you even think that's a smart idea.
I think we've talked about this before, that there's research that would suggest that you can do one thing or another for boys or girls. But sometimes what happens with boys and girls or how their behavior proceeds is depends on the teacher. There's some behavior, I know that may sound bad from an educator, but there's some things that boys just do. And if it's not disrupting the learning environment and hindering from somebody else from learning, then typically we kind of overlook those things. But we don't have any specific thing that we do for boys or girls to help them reach their potential.
I'm chuckling because I was at first grade recess duty this morning with a female teacher, and we were watching several boys just throwing each other on the ground and wrestling and being rough but safe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something I think that educators recognize, that boys like to do some things and they need to move a little bit more and they need some space. I think that means you need to separate them from girls in order to learn? No, I don't think so. But I think good educators are aware that every person is different and is looking for the keys for that person, boy or girl, and regardless of other areas of diversity.
Any differences when you get up into the middle school ages? I think it was Paul mentioned his sons have gotten in a different kind of trouble maybe than a daughter would have.
Mm. I would not say that we necessarily see that at our school, but I think that, you know, we have a culture where we've set expectation around what types of behaviors are acceptable in our classroom and in our school. And so, you know, every student is aware of that, and we don't allow any excuses. We have a no excuses culture, and that applies equally to boys and girls. So,
how does discipline work in your schools? When I should say I went to Catholic school, and punishment was something that if you messed up, you could expect. Does punishment, is that still part of discipline in schools today?
It's interesting. We actually have a really creative way of sort of teaching the concept of action, reward, and consequences.
Right.
And it's called KIPP dollars. So our students actually get KIPP dollars each day that are tied to doing their homework, getting to school on time, the way that they behave in class, et cetera. And then they can bank those toward rewards throughout the year. Those rewards are typically educational field lessons. I'll go and visit a local college, you know, a private school, maybe go visit a corporation in the area. And then at the end of the year, all of those dollars are banked. And if the student has a certain amount of dollars and has also earned the trust of their teachers, they go on a year-end field lesson. And that year-end field lesson is a week-long excursion outside of Dallas, typically. It combines what they've been learning in class in social studies and science with college visits, so just ensuring that our kids are constantly getting that exposure to what college is like starting in fifth grade, and also kind of combining that with the curriculum. So it's kind of neat, and I think that idea of you know, you having control over your destiny is driven home with this KIPP dollar program that we have.
We also have a rewards and consequence system, but we have to provide more frequent feedback for our students. And we have the Fraser book. And so
with the almighty dollar, there you go.
I'll tell you, parents have me laughing because they said that the kids are really supposed to leave the money at school, but they take it home, and they said when they get in the grocery store line, kids are pulling out Fraser books to purchase items. But we have people who actually donate to us so we can run the Fraser store. Mm-hmm. So once the 6 weeks, the kids are rewarded for the same things. They get Fraser books, and they're able to purchase items on campus. But it's important to set the expectations for the students, to remind them of what the expectations are. They help set some of the rules in the classroom, and to constantly remind them of the appropriate behavior, reward them or provide a consequence for what they do. It's a learning process, and it may take all year for our students to get to the point where they're self-disciplined, but it's just a learning process, and definitely rewards and consequences are important for that process.
Yeah, consequences is the key word, I think, to say it's punishment. Those days are gone, and self-discipline is also a big part of that. You know, for us, it's about self-discipline. It's about learning how to get along with others, and it's all part of our character development. And you know, we're striving to help kids learn the intrinsic rewards of being able to do those things.
It must be difficult when you have classrooms full of 20 or 30 kids, and every personality is different. We just have a few seconds left, but is there a way to sort of quickly assess the direction that an entire classroom will take over the course of a year based on that dynamic?
I can kind of assess that based on the teacher, mm-hmm. and the flexibility of the teacher and the understanding of the students. So if the teacher is learning and understanding those students and kind of figuring out how they learn, I know they're going to have a successful year.
Mm-hmm. I would say the same. I mean, it all goes, all roads lead to the teacher.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have all of you. April Allen is Executive Director of the KIPP Truth Academy in Dallas. Leslie Sharp is Principal of Fraser Elementary in DISD. Michael Simpson is Head of the Lower School at Greenhill School. It's been a pleasure to speak to all of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.